Hello, hello. I am Manothi, welcoming you to the From Surviving to Thriving Creativity and Mental Health podcast series. These podcast series are designed and delivered by the Culture, Health and Wellbeing Alliance and funded by the Bearing Foundation. These podcast series were born on the back of a research report co-written by Victoria Hume from the Culture, Health and Wellbeing Alliance and myself. And the report's main focus has been on developing a model that helps us build a sustainable practice in arts and mental health. As part of this podcast series, we are hoping to dive deeper into this model and discuss its recommendations focused on five core groups: practitioners, commissioning organizations, funders, researchers, and infrastructure organizations. On this episode, we are going to be focusing on the recommendations for researchers and what the report means to researchers within the arts, culture, and health space. So no prizes for guessing that I'm joined by two absolutely brilliant experts in this field who most probably live, breathe, and dream research. I have with me Dr. Robin Dowland, postdoc at the Center for Cultural Value, and Dr. Katie Warren, research fellow from University of Edinburgh and University College London. And honestly, I am super excited to have you both join me here today on this podcast episode, where we're going to be diving deeper into the recommendations put together for researchers. So firstly, a very warm welcome to both of you. Robin, do you want to kickstart on this for us?
Thank you so much for inviting me to join in this discussion. So I'm Robin, and I've been working with the Centre for Cultural Value for the past 2.5 years on our culture, health and wellbeing strand. The Centre for Cultural Value is working to build a shared understanding of what culture means to different people in society, and to try and build the evidence base around different practices. So I've been looking at kind of research reviewing for the past 2.5 years to find out what we know, what we don't know, and what future research could focus on. I guess my background is in music, so I'm not a musician. I think my mum would say I am a musician. She funded the violin lessons for many years. But I'm a psychologist by background, but I did my PhD research in music for people with dementia, and kind of understanding in the moment benefits of music making, which is very much tied into these kind of big questions of how do we capture value in this area? How do we understand what it means, what cultural experiences mean to different people? So that's what I'm really interested in.
Katie, would you like to give it a go as well?
Sure. Thanks so much, Manothi, for inviting me today. And it's great to be here with Robin as well. Yes, so I'm Katie. As you heard, I'm a research fellow at UCL and at the University of Edinburgh. So at UCL, I'm based in the Department of Behavioural Science and Health, where I'm also Deputy Director of our new World Health Organization Collaborating Centre for Arts and Health. So we're doing a lot of international work at the moment. My work at UCL focuses on understanding the role of the arts in improving health and well-being. And at the University of Edinburgh, I'm based in the Edinburgh Centre for Research on the Experience of Dementia, where I'm currently working on developing a new programme of research exploring the arts and creativity in dementia care. A bit like Robin, I suppose, I came at this field through music, but I very much work across all different art forms. I similarly had an upbringing of lots of musical engagement at school and things like that. So I came at it thinking about wanting to be involved with singing research and learning about how music affects us and what are the mechanisms underpinning how music affects our health and well-being. But I'm very interested in all different art forms. My PhD was in sociology at the University of Edinburgh. And again, I suppose similar to Robin, my PhD was actually in cultural value and trying to understand the processes of meaning making. So I think there's a bit of overlap there with some of Robin's interests as well. And I'm very interested in these bigger questions around, like, how do the arts affect us, and what meaning do they have for us, and what value do they have, and how does that relate to policy questions around the value that the arts have in society?
Amazing. Thank you very much, Robin and Katie. And that's very interesting to know that both of you all have a lot of sort of commonalities in terms of the connection with music. So we've got two people who are very passionate about music, and I myself am very passionate about dance and sort of understanding the impact of dance on our overall health and well-being. So this is definitely going to be a very interesting conversation. So moving on to my next question, which I guess might be a bit of a challenge to answer because both of y'all wear multiple hats. But I would be very keen to understand, what does a normal day, well, a day look like? I'm sure that no 2 days are normal for both of you. So Robin, would you like to start off us off, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you say, every day is very different for me. But for the most part, I am sat behind a computer screen at the moment. I think that comes with doing secondary research, is there's a lot of time spent reading and kind of extrapolating what information's out there about a given topic. So we've been looking at a really wide range of topics in our culture, health, wellbeing theme, ranging from arts and culture on prescription or referral, young people's mental health, training and development of healthcare students. And then most recently, in the last week even, we've just published two reviews on older people, one that's focused more on physical health outcomes, which I'm sure you'll be interested in because there's a lot of dance-focused studies within that review. And then the other one, working in collaboration, our first collaborative review with the Connecting Through Culture as We Age project at the University of Bristol, to understand the kind of the value of arts and cultural experiences in supporting older people's sense of well-being and also their kind of feelings of social connectivity. So we're kind of moving into our second theme with our second older people research digest and kind of moving more into this world of cultural participation, which obviously has incredibly strong links to culture in terms of our health and well-being as well. And people still want to know how cultural participation links to well-being. So that's kind of what I've been working on most recently. And the other thing that I've been working on is we're calling it kind of a vision paper, as it were. It's kind of, I'm not sure I necessarily like the term vision paper. It sounds like we know everything about everything that there is to know about arts and health, but it's more of a kind of our reflections on this research area, having been kind of immersed in it for the past 2.5 years. So what do we think the strengths are in research in this area? And what do we think can be done to maybe kind of build on the evidence that we already have to really ensure that we're kind of building a really evidence-focused agenda within this area and kind of understanding how that evidence links to policy? What makes people interested in this area? So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing, Robin. And it's great to know, the evidence link to all that you're doing, because that's something that we're going to be touching upon later in this conversation as well. Katie, how about you?
I think similarly to Robin, my work is very varied. No 2 days are the same, and I love it that way. So it's great to have a job that I really enjoy and get to do all kinds of different things. At the Collaborating Centre, we categorise our work within research, policy and development. And I think in some ways that reflects quite a lot of my role. So I'm either doing research, carrying out empirical research that could be collecting or analysing data, or thinking about literature reviews or larger data sets. Our department do a lot of epidemiological work as well as a more intervention-based studies. And then in the policy side of things, we could be writing policy reports, or it could be about just translating the evidence in policy spaces, whether that's giving evidence or giving presentations at conferences. And our development strand, we have a big ECR program, the Arts Health Early Career Research Network, and we've got our upcoming research intensive, which is a training course happening in May. So I sort of do quite a lot of things across those different strands, and that sort of reflects my broader interests as well, and a passion around trying to translate evidence into different spaces, whether that's community spaces or policy engagement. So to give a few examples of projects I'm working on, at UCL, we're currently working with WHO Europe to scale up a singing for postnatal depression intervention in Denmark and Romania. So this project is based on previous research from the UK, which found that singing can reduce PND by 38% and lead to a faster recovery when compared to usual care. So we're taking that knowledge, and we're working with Cluj Culture Centre in Romania and the Central Denmark region to explore how to adapt or translate or change this intervention for these new cultural contexts and think carefully about what these populations in different environments may need or want in relation to this kind of intervention, because we certainly can't just lift it and implement it. We need to think about the sensitivity of the new environment, and we're working with people on the ground to deliver them. Another project which I think you might be interested in, Manoti, is the Dance Connect study, where we were looking at the benefits of online dance for young people living with anxiety. We've actually come to the end of the online classes as part of the intervention, but we're just analysing the data and writing up the results of that. So I'd say watch this space for more results on that soon. I think it's going to be a really exciting results to share in relation to that. Things at Edinburgh. So I'm quite new to my role there, but I'm working on two strands of research development. Firstly, I've been working with Dance Space, who were actually also part of the Dance Connect study, and also Scottish Ballet, to apply for funding to explore the gaps in the dance for dementia literature. So there's quite a lot of work out there delivering interventions, but we want to take a bit of a step back and say what's missing now and have a bit of a reflective space rather than just always continually carrying out research and really unpacking, like, what do we need to know and where's best to invest in the future. And secondly, much of the research at the centre I work at, ECRED, it's called Edinburgh Centre for Research on the Experience of Dementia, draws upon participatory approaches. I think we're going to be talking a lot about that today because it's very much embedded in your report about co-production. But something else I've been working on is to develop ways to synthesize learnings across different ways of approaching co-production. I think that term is used quite broadly in different contexts, and there's a lot of work around how we can optimize ways of working. And I'm looking at that in a particular context of co-produced dementia work that embeds creativity at the heart of it.
Wow, lots of projects, and really all of these sound very, very interesting, very, very fascinating. I would love to understand if, at a personal capacity, at a personal level, have you really sort of felt the impact of arts and creativity on mental health? It could be yourself or it could be somebody else you were working with.
So actually the idea behind the Dance Connect study was very much from personal experience. So throughout the lockdown, I started doing online dance classes. I've never really been a dancer before. I'm very new to it, but I just loved it. I found it so, it helped me to engage in the moment. It helped me to access what we often call flow experiences. Really that sense of just like going with the flow, being in the moment, feeling focused, and I felt very energized after the classes. And it was a time where I was struggling a little bit myself with anxiety, and I really felt like it supported me. So that formed the basis for some of the initial ideas that I had to develop this dance study for young people online. I worked with some colleagues, Laura Wright at Edinburgh, Saoirse Finn and Karen Mack at UCL, and we sort of pulled all of our ideas together to identify who could benefit most from this. So we ended up with a study that we delivered, Dance Connect, but that really was underpinned by my own experiences. And then I've had firsthand experience. Like, I feel very privileged to have seen so many people benefit from arts and culture. A few sort of things that I would pick out as being quite poignant to me. One thing was when I used to work at Charleston Westminster Hospital, I felt very privileged to be a part of music for somebody who was in palliative care. And it really impacted the family. And this was a shared moment very towards the end of a loved one's life. And it hugely helped to support the family with grieving and going through that process. So I very much saw how the arts could provide support. That was a musical engagement. But I have also been involved with palliative care with other kinds of arts as well, like visual arts, for example, in rooms. And so we can support bereavement rooms and decorate them in a way that it makes it easier to share these kinds of difficult conversations. And another one would be around the 10 of Us Cancer Choirs project, which I was involved with. So we implemented singing interventions for those who were affected by cancer. And it was just so much fun and so positive to see people uplifted in this group, collective, shared experience of singing together. There's nothing quite like it. I'm sure that listeners will have had this experience themselves. But if you haven't, I urge you to go join a community choir where you can really feel the vibrations of people around you singing together. It's been something that we've lost a lot of during the pandemic. So I hope that now, as we return to in-person engagement, we can feel the positivity of that. And I've got loads of memories of hearing people singing together and afterwards saying how uplifted and positive they felt afterwards and how it really had tangible effects on their health and well-being. This was not just a one-off experience, that actually coming back again was providing consistent support and a support in their lives that they couldn't gain elsewhere.
Amazing. Robin, would you like to add anything to this?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I'll take you back on my journey when I was deciding what to study at university. I think that's probably the kind of pivotal moment, because it was between music, theatre studies and psychology, which I was choosing between to study at university. All I knew was that I wanted to form a career out of something that was going to really support people's well-being. I didn't know what that job was going to look like, but thankfully this area kind of took off in the last sort of 10 years whilst I've been going through that kind of journey. So when I came out of my undergrad, I moved to Manchester and I started volunteering with Manchester Camerata, who are an orchestra based in Manchester, on their Songlines project, which was a music and theatre based programme for young people with autism and their peers. And I was doing a bit of support of the evaluation of this programme, but I was mainly there to kind of help out on the ground. I wasn't one of the music practitioners, I wasn't one of the theatre practitioners, but I was just in this space and able to just interact with all these young people to create just the most amazing performance. And it stuck with me. And then by some, just the stars aligned, and Manchester Camerata found some funding to do a programme around music and dementia. And so that's how my PhD came to be about, was working with Manchester Camerata as an ESRC case studentship, which I think has really kind of aligned my thinking in this area, because everything I've done has always been driven by kind of a cultural organisation and what they see on the ground and how can research support that kind of activity. So I was very lucky to kind of have Music in Mind, which is their programme for people with dementia, as my kind of case study for my PhD research. And I was able to embed myself as a researcher within the music group over 15 weeks and really trying to actually take part in the music making, to be a researcher who's not afraid to kind of get into the circle and form relationships and play music and experience the kind of joy within the circle. So that was I had to reflect a lot about this on my thesis and had many questions in my viva about that kind of researcher hat versus participant hat. But just the impacts that you would see by sitting in the circle rather than being an outside observer were just phenomenal to me. So yeah, that's a very long-winded way to answer your question. Yes, I see it all the time, the impact that arts and culture can have on people's mental health and well-being.
Yeah, absolutely, and couldn't agree more. And I think it's really good to know that both of you have had sort of the more practical, you know, firsthand experience of either being a participant or either facilitating these sort of sessions, and also the experience of how do you sort of assess that all and make it into a research study or an evidence-based study. So it's great to know that you both have that, both the angles on and both those hats on when you were looking at this report as well. So I would love to dive in and understand what's your first impression about the From Surviving to Thriving report, because one of the things that we were very conscious of is that we wanted to make this report as relevant and as practical as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, well, I was very happy when it arrived in my inbox. I knew the report was in the making. I was involved in some very, very, very early discussions. But I think it's something, I think the thing that I take from it that's really important is this kind of interconnectivity of stakeholders within culture, health and wellbeing. There's so many people involved in the decision making and the implementing and the kind of practical elements of running programs, and also such a wide range of people who benefit from taking part in these sort of programs. So I think it's really highlighted, and I know, Katie, you've done a lot of work in this area, the kind of the complexity of culture, health and wellbeing, and how we all need to be talking together in order to further the research agenda, to further the practice agenda going forwards. And I love that it's so kind of recommendation focused as well. There's a lot of times that you see things where it's a lot of discussion and then it's kind of, okay, what's the action? So I like a good what next, where do we go from this?
Absolutely. And I completely agree with you. I think one of the things that even we struggle with, because there is no shortage, I'm sure y'all would know, there's no shortage of reports out there. But I think what we sometimes, like you said, Robin, what we sometimes face, you know, in terms of challenges is that, so what next? Then what do we do with all this amazing data and all this amazing evaluation? So it's great to know that the recommendations sort of hit a chord with you. Katie, how about yourself? What were your first impressions?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I definitely agree with Robin about the interconnectivity of all the different components of it. I think what Robin was referencing there around some of what I've worked on is I've looked a bit at the active ingredients of arts and culture. And within that, we've had a look at all the different complex components, or often coined active ingredients, have to come together to potentially impact upon health and well-being. And I think this report really quite well identifies the different infrastructural components that are involved in an arts and health intervention that we often don't think about. These are some of the things that are behind the scenes. So I think it's really good at bringing to light all of those different organizations, sectors, the infrastructure, the systems that are involved. So I loved that about it and definitely would agree with Robin. I think one quite simple thing that I love about it is actually the word sustainability, which is in the title. I think it's a topic that's really overlooked in this field, and particularly by funders. There are so many short-term projects and project-based funding. I think it's a huge priority to be thinking about sustainable models. So to have a report that actually has that in the title as a key component of work in this area really excites me. I think we've got the evidence to show that the art supports mental health now. There's quite a rich evidence base there. And now I think we need to move on to think more about infrastructure and how to access the arts programs that we know are beneficial to our health and well-being. So the recommendations set out in this report are quite a nice bridge into what I think is a priority in the future to think about infrastructural questions. I also really liked the focus on diversity and inclusion, which is a really important area. And I know Robin knows a lot about that as well and has looked at that in her own research. And I was happy to see co-production appearing time and time again, page after page, which was really exciting. It's something we're quite activist about at the Edinburgh Centre for Research and Experience of Dementia. And we're trying to change the stigma around lived experience researchers and advocate for funders to invest more in these kinds of projects, particularly those that place the dementia experience at the heart of them. So it's really useful to have this spotlighted for someone like myself who's trying to gain awareness and to build activism around this area and to gain funding for co-produced projects as well. So yeah, I think it's a great report, and my first impressions were all very positive, and I was excited to read through this and see lots of the things there that I've been thinking about over and over again as well.
Brilliant. It's just sort of a reconfirmation of, you know, what we set out to do is somewhere, you know, connecting and hitting the right notes. And both of you have touched upon that sort of stakeholders and you know, looking at it from the point of view of five core groups. And that's what we've tried to do through this thriving practice model, is to really sort of dive deeper into those five core groups. And I think it'll be really interesting to know specifically around the researchers' recommendations that we have outlined. I would love to know which of these recommendations, you know, sort of connected with you the most and why. And if there's more than one, then feel free to share that as well. So yeah, Robin, would you want to start us off on this one?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that every single point resonated with the work that I've been doing. Just to start off with, I probably won't go into too much detail on all of them, but just pick out a few that I think are particularly important with regards to the work that we've been doing at the Centre for Cultural Value. So I think something that kind of caught my eye immediately was this kind of working with practitioners and people with lived experience from the beginning right through to the conclusion of your research. I think that it should be at the heart of everything that we do as researchers within this area. And I think there are some really fantastic examples of this out there. But for example, in picking out the kind of literature that I've been looking at, the majority of sort of authors on research papers, while they're multidisciplinary in sort of background, which is great to see, you very rarely see practitioners representative from cultural organisations represented within kind of author lists for publications. and also the kind of experiences of cultural organisations and practitioners who are kind of working on the ground doing these projects, seeing these amazing impacts, are so rarely captured in the research literature. So for example, we did a review back in, well, it must have been pre-pandemic, we started the review on practitioners' experiences of working in healthcare settings. And I was only able to find two peer-reviewed studies that directly explored the impacts of research, the kind of experiences and impacts on practitioner well-being, things like that. And I know that this has kind of taken off recently, the wonderful work of Nicola Naismith and Daniel Reagan. But it's just really interesting, and I think rightly so, to kind of make sure that researchers are working with people who have been, who've had all these experiences for many, many years and have developed their practice, and actually ensuring that practitioners' voices are represented in the literature so that they can see how the research can kind of help their practice, as well as kind of, we don't want to just go in and kind of take all these stories and then write up a publication. It's, research has got to be useful for practitioners, for cultural organisations, as well as kind of sharing how impactful and valuable these things are for the people taking part. So that was something that really struck a chord with me, and especially in kind of involving people throughout. So not writing a research bid until you've got those kind of partnerships established, not just bringing people on board at the last minute to kind of show you've got a cultural sector partner, for example. And I think this ties into this kind of prioritization of long-term research and building these long-term relationships. What we've found is that there's a real need for really rigorous mixed methods research that kind of looks at these more kind of in the moment micro level benefits, impacts, outcomes, but also follows people in the longer term. So for example, our culture on referral research review, there was very little follow-up of what happened after, say, a 10-week programme. So what happens to people after they're no longer engaging in an arts and cultural programme? What happens to their mental health and well-being then? Are people feeling more connected to their communities as a result? That's what we'd really like as a result of a social prescription. What happens to these people? And I think it's only through those kind of long-term programmes that are supported by really strong partnerships and practices that we can get some way towards that. So I'll stop talking now, but if there's anything that Katie says that I can, I'll jump in on afterwards.
Yeah, I think I very much agree with you, Robin. It's interesting you picked out that line about co-production and starting from the beginning, because it was actually that line that really stood out for me as well, like the word beginning and thinking about practitioners and those with lived experience from the very start, because the start sort of varies for different people. As the researcher looking for funding, obviously starts quite a lot before you may actually even involve a practitioner, which tends to come a bit later down the line once the funding has already been attained, or potentially even after an ethical process through an ethical board at a university. So that word stood out for me, because I thought, to really make systemic change, we need to think about how we can get funding to get people in earlier, so that people with lived experience can be there for the critical decision-making processes. So yeah, I thought that was quite interesting to hear Robin pick out that same line that I'd seen as well, which was interesting. Other things that stood out for me, I think, was around this idea for need to advocate for institutional change, thinking about that in relation to co-production and methodologies and practice. There was an interesting line around research being dominated by white Western methodologies and art forms. And I think this is something that we're all quite aware of in research. And in some spaces, we're more aware of it than others. But I do actually think in a lot of spaces, it can fall to the background. And we know that it's there. But it does become a little bit like that kind of elephant in the room. We're not really unpacking it. We're not really thinking about the kinds of measures that we're using and why we're using them and the history that's behind them. So it was quite exciting to see that there written in ink and as something that we can reference and say, we really do need to take this very seriously and think about why there are these kind of cultural biases in the kind of research that we're delivering, and how we can unpack that and how we can improve access to both research and research delivery and the interventions or activity communities that we're researching. So it's on both sides of the coin there that we need to think about these cultural biases and access. And that kind of links to some of the work that I was reading there around social determinants of health as well, and health equity, which caught my attention too. So we've been exploring inequalities in arts and cultural engagement at population level at UCL. So we're also really aware of those kinds of challenges of access. So it was great to see that as a priority area too. And I suppose similar to Robin, so much of it stood out to me and was a lot of what I'm thinking about on a day-to-day basis. So there were so many things I could talk about, but those were just a few things that sort of stood out for discussion, I'd say.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. And I think I completely agree. I feel like co-production is obviously a terminology that is used very often, but it is that the foundation definitely needs to be that shared ownership and that shared ownership right from step one, right till the end, and then some after maybe. And just thinking about what you mentioned, Robin, about, you know, what happens to the participants after a program ends. When we were doing this sort of initial groundwork of interviewing lots and lots of practitioners and people within this space, it was kind of amazing to know so many people had the same sort of question in their mind that I really want to know what happens to those people. Like, is there a way in which I can get in touch with them after 1 year, after 2 years, after 3 years, to map out that journey, to map out that actual impact, which I think is, I guess, acknowledging that this needs to happen is step one. Acknowledging that we need to address cultural bias is step one, you know, and only when we acknowledge that there is a problem will we tend to find a solution for it. And I think what we are trying to do with this report is that, you know, obviously acknowledging, but also building on that awareness as to how you can then embed these recommendations in real time. And that's exactly what I'm hoping to ask both of you, is that what would be your sort of suggestion if you were to speak to people within your industry, your colleagues? How do you think is the best way to approach this report and actually utilize and implement it in real time? And feel free, I give you all the liberty to choose who wants to go first.
I don't mind chipping in first. I think something that I always have a conversation, well, I've had many conversations about with cultural organizations is practice time and research time. It seems like the clock moves so much slower in research than it does in practice. And that's one of the key challenges on top of all these fantastic recommendations is actually implementing them might take quite a lot of time. We have some fantastic early career researchers, mid-career researchers, people leading centres in this area who have kind of really fed into this area, but we need that kind of sustainability in research as well. So for example, can we find a way to have a cohort of early career researchers coming out of their PhDs who work on a co-research based project on several different areas, for example? Like, how do we create this kind of new generation of researchers who can kind of take on this baton and challenge the system? It's kind of, you have to kind of get people from a wider range of backgrounds than are perhaps currently represented within this field of research to come in and really shake things up. I mean, I'm happy to contribute to any conversations in this area, but I think it's really about, yeah, taking these recommendations and implementing them into action. I mean, it's the smallest thing sometimes. Like, there's the point about publishing open access so that people have the ability to look at the research themselves and make decisions for themselves. But it's also the other way around. It's cultural organizations making their evaluation reports public so that we can learn from what has come before, so that we're not just reinventing the wheel time and time again. You have people at conferences saying, I've done that before. I've been doing this innovative thing for 10 years. And it's like, oh, I didn't know you were doing that. which is, yeah, as a national centre and the capacity that I have as a solo researcher, sometimes finding somewhere where all this information is available is fantastic. So it's kind of working together to kind of not make research easy, because research is complicated, but to develop these relationships to ensure that the work is really authentically co-produced, and not just a kind of, oh, we'll grab a cultural organization to feed in, but actually, why are we doing this research? What's our motivations for it? What are the cultural organization, what are the practitioners, who about people with lived experience, what do they want to get out of it? Because there are just so many boundaries that are placed by universities. It's kind of that whole like ivory tower scenario. How do we get researchers out into the real world and supporting really kind of innovative, co-created, co-produced, and also creative research that isn't necessarily based in the methodologies that we've seen so far. So yeah, not a simple answer, but hopefully.
It's a good start. Thank you, Robin. Katie?
Yeah, I think I very much echo Robin's sentiment. I think I'd go one step further even around that kind of shaking up the system to say we need funding to do that. So I was really lucky that my PhD was an AHRC studentship, and I worked in partnership with the Edinburgh Festival Fringe Society. And they were so forward thinking and allowed me to think really critically about cultural value in the context of delivering their work. And I think we really need more spaces like that where people can have the time to reflect and think critically, because often when you're part of the university system, as Robin said, there are quite a lot of structural barriers. And obviously doing a PhD, you're very much a part of that too. But I don't just mean in PhD spaces. You know, we can do things within the community, we can do things in policy spaces, but we really need the resources to be able to actually have those spaces to critically think. So I think a lot of the benefits of this report is it's something tangible to share with funders and say these are priorities that you should be thinking about when thinking about where to invest in the future. So I think that's a really exciting practical thing about the report, that we can share it with funders and with policymakers as well and say here's something to listen to and think about. And the second thing I think is quite simple really, but I think that sometimes a key application is a space for conversation. And it's like what we're doing today is actually having this report as a stimulus for debate. And I think this report could be used in spaces in working environments, whether that's internal meetings or inviting funders, partner organizations, arts organizations, practitioners together to discuss this report. And it could be a really interesting place for starting those critical discussions. And it feels like quite a small step, but sometimes I think those small steps are what lead to bigger change. And we might be working towards systemic change eventually, but having this report at this stage to have those conversations, I think is really important. And it's about kind of shifting away from some of the language that we're a bit stuck in some ways. I think impact work is actually very important. There's quite a lot of stigma around using impact these days, I think, but it is important because policy making is still very much driven by evidence-based work and thinking about outcomes. But I like that this report is saying let's think beyond that, and we do need to think beyond that. We need to think about systems and scaling up, and we're doing a lot of that work at UCL, and we're thinking more about population level engagements, as I said earlier, thinking about arts and cultural engagement across the life course. So not just thinking about that one-off engagement, as we were saying, there are challenges around that Robin was describing, thinking about how people actually engage across the life course and how that impacts upon health and wellbeing beyond a one-off engagement. So there's a lot to do there around sustainable models. And I think this report will be a good step into thinking more about those kinds of approaches and thinking about systemic change, which is really exciting.
So thank you so much to both of you for sharing your feedback and your suggestions as well. Some really interesting practical recommendations on how you could potentially start the conversation and try to implement certain recommendations that we've outlined in this report. And obviously, we're sort of coming to the end of the podcast, but before I ask you all to sort of share your final thoughts, I thought that it'll be nice to for our listeners to get to know a little bit more about the person that both of you are. So I'm going to be asking you a very random question, which I hope y'all don't mind. If you had to describe yourself as a food dish, what would that be? Katie, would you like to start on this?
But I suppose if I had to think of something, it would probably be something sweet, because I have a real massive sweet tooth. And I think that also I am somebody who kind of is constantly go, go, go. And I'm very energized. And I am just sort of constantly like wanting to do things quickly. So I think it probably have to be something like a cake, which is very sugary and very sweet, potentially a red velvet, just because I like those.
Awesome. Well, I love that. And I love red velvet as well. Robin, how about you?
So this question I was once asked as part of a job interview for a well-known supermarket chain. And the only thing I could think of was, it's so cringy, but a fruit salad, because there's a bit of me that everybody likes, which is so cringe. But thinking about it now, these days, I was 18 back then, I've literally got something in the slow cooker at the moment, I'd say. Something that is heart, like a hearty stew or something like that. So it takes a bit of effort to just, you kind of have to put it all together, but then leave it to just sit with itself and come together over time. So I'd say I'm a bit of a slower thinker, even though my brain zaps off 100 miles an hour. I need that time to sit and just come together with my thoughts.
I'm really jealous of Robin's fruit salad example. Oh
God, I was so embarrassed at the time when I said it.
I think that's great. And also, you know, you're well prepared for when this question pops up again.
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is only the second time in my life this question has come up, so.
And let's hope that there's never a third for this one. But thank you for indulging in my randomness. Any final thoughts, any final reflections, and potentially any, tune in to, feel free, this is your space, that the listeners.
I think for recommendations of podcasts, I'd recommend Robin's podcast at the Centre for Cultural Value, which is absolutely fantastic. It's really well put together. Do listen to that if you haven't listened to it already. With regards to any sort of final reflections, I think sort of building what we were saying about early career researchers, I think one thing that's very important is to think about how to get these conversations to early career researchers. And there's a lot of people at the moment, I think, following the pandemic, who've maybe come out of university and wondering how to engage in different research spaces and who to speak to. And there's a lot of interest in arts and health. So I think it would be quite important for us to ensure that this report can reach those at the start of their careers, as well as the stakeholders that we've been talking about, so around the policymakers and the funders, and researchers obviously incredibly important, but I think we need to look at how to bring in new voices into these spaces as well. So that would be my kind of final reflection, is like, let's ensure that we can get ECRs involved with this. We've got, as I said, our research intensive coming up in May, so I can be one step to sharing it then, but I hope that other listeners will consider thinking about how we can ensure that students and those who are new to this field will be able to read this as well.
Yeah, I guess just echoing what Katie said, I think there are a good body of researchers working in this area at the moment, and I am so open to having those conversations with people who are interested in the field, who want to get involved. So as well as sharing this fantastic report and getting to those people who are deciding what they want to do with the kind of work that they're doing, I think it's as the researchers being as open as possible to those people. It's always the thing I say to my students when I'm supporting them with their dissertations. If there's a paper that really interests you, drop the research, the first author, an email. It might take them 3 months to get back to you, but like, most people are open to it, open to those discussions. So don't be afraid to contact people. Everyone's very friendly in this field, like incredibly friendly. Thank you for the podcast plug, Katie. There's just been a new series released, so that's all looking at cultural participation, which was very fun to record.
Awesome. Thank you so much, both of you. Absolutely fantastic to have this conversation with you. And thank you for being so honest and practical and concise with your suggestions, with your feedback about this report as well. I'm sure that everybody who's tuned in is going to learn a great deal, not just about the report, but also a great deal about the sector in general and the role that each of us can play to make it more sustainable and to make it more thriving. And for those of you who are listening in to this podcast, I would definitely recommend possibly taking a pen on paper and just jotting down your personal reflections out of this conversation as well. I always find that it's a great way of adding value to your learning and to your experience. And yes, please don't forget to sign up to our newsletters at culturehealthandwellbeing.org.uk. That's where you will get all the latest that's happening in the sector, but that's also where you will find the report, which we've been talking about, in case you didn't realize. You can download that report. And also, we've got some more episodes in this podcast series that you can access through the website. So I definitely recommend you logging on to culturehealthandwellbeing.org.uk. But until then, thank you very much for joining us. And hopefully, yes, wishing all of you a brilliant, fantastic, creative day ahead. And thanks again, Katie and Robin. It's been an absolute pleasure to have both of you join us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been great to be involved.
These podcasts are designed and delivered by the Culture, Health and Wellbeing Alliance and kindly funded by the Baring Foundation.